Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Hey, welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. I'm on here with Max Morgan, and Max, our guest today is Detective Heidi Chance. Welcome to the podcast, Heidi.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's so good to have you on. For our listeners, I want to do a quick little bio because this is a true woman of passion, badass woman in the law enforcement area, 27 plus year law enforcement veteran. Motivational speaker, founder of A Chance for Awareness, and now author of a book called Talk to Them. And I know we're going to talk about all that, but Heidi, thank you so much for coming on the No One Fights Alone podcast. We love having people like you on and just telling their stories.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with just how you even got in law enforcement. Let's start there. I know that you have a real passion. Obviously, you're still killing it after 27 years, and something drives that. But what was the sparkle in your eye that brought you to the law enforcement game?
Yeah. So hopefully, I look like I started when I was 12 because I did start. When
you
I
do. You look very young, Heidi.
Good. Yay. In high school, my dad came home one day, my senior year, and said, hey, there's this new program. It was actually a program back in the day, but new, 20 years later, I guess, called the Cadet Trainee Program. And he said, you might be interested in it because I wanted to go to the Air Force because I knew I wanted to be a police officer, follow in my dad's footsteps. He was Phoenix PD for 26 years. And then when he retired, he went and did another 12 years with Maricopa County Sheriff's Office and retired. So he's living that second pension life. But I applied for the position, and it was 1,000 people, because obviously back then it was law enforcement sworn and then this position, and made it through the whole process and became badge number two, and the first female cadet that Phoenix Police Department's ever had. And so that's where I pretty much started with my interest in law enforcement. Also, my dad is my hero, and following his footsteps is a great honor to be able to do that. So that is what I chose to do.
I find it interesting when we have Blue Blood family members on here. It you really can hear an added level of passion and enthusiasm about how this is a family. And I hear it in your voice as well. I mean, is that true? Would that be fair?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm actually third generation. So my grandfather, he was NYPD. And so when my dad and I went back to New York for a funeral for one of our family members back there, he showed me where his dad's precinct was and the garment district. And he was like a walking beat guy and, shared stories with my uncle about, ironically, an incident where he was chasing someone and he went around one of the buildings, and for whatever reason, the suspect thought he was a taxi and got in the back seat. And what's funny about that, he arrested himself, basically. What's funny about that is I kind of had the story like that as well. I was a school resource officer. I went to one of the schools nearby that was kind of like a charter school. I was dispatched out there for a kid that showed up that they knew had an active warrant. So, of course, when I walked in, he ran, and I don't, lose people. So, and I get paid by the hour. So I basically drove all over the neighborhood, up and down on the PA. I actually said, I get paid by the hour. We can do this all day. And then I finally found him popped out on one of the major roadways, and I pulled up to him and I said, hey, are you going to get in or are you going to run again? Because I'm ready to do this all day long. And he literally opened up the back door and got in and arrested himself.
I love that.
Yeah.
Your law enforcement Uber has arrived. It's here.
Yeah. I'm very convincing that I'm not going to give up.
Oh, that's so great. Did your dad ever worry, or did he really just kind of like, she's a badass, she's going to kill it, I don't worry about that.
You know, because
there's this partner thing, you know, like, you know, I don't worry too much, or I do, but then you become this parent and you're like, this has a different look.
Yeah. What he worried about, not me working patrol or as a police officer, he worried that I would change when I went to vice. That's what he worried about. Because obviously that element, you are in an element where you're hanging out in strip clubs, you are with really evil people that you're as an undercover trying to build rapport with and engage with, and then obviously develop your case. So that's what he actually worried about. Because when I said I wanted to go to Vice, he had been in Vice, and he said, no, I don't want you to do that.
Yeah. Because he knew. He knew the darkness was there.
Yeah.
It's a different world.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. The higher you go and then closer to the tip of the spear you become in law enforcement, the more you dip your toe in the evil and dark side, feel like you have to stay there sometimes. And we've all seen it, but some of us spend more time there than others. Well, that's great. So let's go back to your career. We're building up your career, your badge number two. Take us on the next step. What happens in your career then?
Yeah. So after, back in the cadet trainee days, I did about 2 years. And then when I went to the academy for realsies, I was 20, and then I turned 21 3 weeks before I graduated. And so when I graduated, I went to a different precinct because I wanted, you know, to explore a different area of Phoenix. If you guys are familiar with Phoenix, I was assigned in South Phoenix as a cadet with a light blue shirt, a baton, a radio, and pepper spray, in a fully marked police car, driving around investigating accidents, dusting for fingerprints, female searches. But obviously in a fully marked patrol car, I got flagged down on all kinds of emergencies, and people aren't going to see the light blue shirt and think anything other than police. And so I've gotten myself in a lot of tricky situations at 18, 19 years old in South Phoenix. But I survived all of that and then went into the academy, and I went to Maryville Precinct when I graduated from the academy for real. And I definitely loved Maryville Precinct. It was, I call it like where all the bad guys live. They go commit their crimes, and then all of the pursuits and things lead back to where they actually stay. And that's where I worked. Very residential, a lot of non-speaking English people that, you know, I had to pick up a lot of Spanish. I wish I have kept it. You know, you try and keep it, but unless you use it all the time, you lose it. I regret not maintaining my Spanish for sure. And then I became a mother. I got pregnant, and I wanted to have, some stable schedule for my child. So I ended up testing for and getting a position as a school resource officer. And I thought that was only going to be like for a minute, and then I'd get back to patrol, because I really had no issue with going to patrol and being a regular beat cop. And I blinked and 6 years went by. Wow. And I had a great time as a school resource officer. I definitely had some incidents that, you know, if we do those things today, we'd be in the news. I mean, I had, like, the day that I showed up, the very first day as an SRO, I parked my car out front of the school like you're supposed to. And when I was at lunch, one of the custodians ran in and she said, someone's tagging your patrol car. So I come out and I see the person and I chase them. I find them. They've got the little tip thing of the spray. It was purple, in his pocket. And he had tagged "fuck the police" down the side of my patrol car. So I got welcomed into the neighborhood. but yes, I had a lot of adventure as a school resource officer. But what me into investigating? Yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna comment on the school resource officer piece. Oftentimes I hear people grunt and groan about, oh my goodness, I'm assigned to school. as a school resource officer. But what I find in my experience in talking to people who have lived that assignment out is that it's very enriching and very rewarding assignment. And most of them talk very endearing about their time in those positions. Very few people have I met that didn't really look at their school resource time, school resource officer tenure as a real positive. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's our opportunity to show the youth that we're human and that we're just like them. Yeah. So I think that's invaluable.
Yeah. I think it gets a lot of people to, I'm over the school resource officers in our department, and it gets the young kids, they get to see firsthand, you know, about law enforcement, and you can make a huge impact on some of these kids' life that are in, you know, junior high school. And I mean, there's a lot of people that become cops themselves because of their school resource officer.
Yes, absolutely.
Arguably change the entire direction of their life just from this simple interaction, who maybe not have direction at home or maybe not have any influence at home. Now you've got a, you know, some type of positive influence that's redirecting their energy to something less destructive. Yeah, yeah, love that. So I interrupted you. You were fixing to say something about a promotion to in investigations, I think, maybe.
Yeah. So after being a school resource officer, I don't get to take the patrol car home. I don't think your guys do, right? You have to return it to the station every day and come pick it up.
We take ours home.
But, oh, you're so lucky. We cannot take it home. In fact, those cars, I think, were on the road 20 hours out of 24. Our patrol cars were run into the ground. But anyway, going to the station one day at the end of my 6 years there, I was returning the keys, and I happened to pass the juvenile holding area where there was a girl that I recognized because I saw her in the window, and I was like, hey, wait a minute. Is that so-and-so? Why are you in trouble? And, you know, she recognized me as the cop from her school when she was in seventh or eighth grade. And basically, she had told me that she was under arrest for prostitution. And this was back in, like, 2004-ish, 2005. And, you know, I had been a cop already for 6 years, and I was just blown away that a kid could get involved in prostitution. And so I uniquely also started getting asked by the vice unit at the time to do the undercover street stings where you have females from patrol pose as prostitutes out on the street. And so those things all happened at the same time. And that's what sparked my interest in testing for a position with the vice unit. And, you know, when I went there in January of 2009, I stayed the whole rest of my career.
And I think what I'm sensing is that there was a shock of sorts that happened when you'd been around the block a while, you'd been doing this job for a while, and this kind of got thrown on you, and the impact of that was like, holy cow, I've never seen this, or maybe not even heard of it.
Well, I thought it was adults.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially that somebody that you knew.
How old was she? How do you think she was?
So when I knew her, when she was at the school, she was in seventh or eighth grade, so 13, 14-ish. And on that day, when I ran into her again, she was 16, almost 17. And, wow. You know, she was arrested or in custody with her boyfriend, who was obviously an adult. So she was in the juvenile area. And she was in love with this guy and, you know, named it, you know, frankly, as the crime, obviously prostitution, but didn't realize that she was being trafficked or any of those things. And neither did I, actually. Back when this all went down, we had three squads, and you had predominantly male detectives on each squad and only one female position allowed on each squad because the intent with the purpose of the squad was to pursue arresting prostitutes. That's what we did all day long, misdemeanor arrests, street prostitution. And every now and again, they would do an operation targeting demand, which are the buyers of trafficking victims, sex buyers. But they really didn't need female officers, they thought. And so I've actually witnessed through this whole change of how we have changed our behavior and how we, target this problem, where now you have the squads outweighing female officers to male detectives, because you really need female undercovers to pursue the true bad guys contributing to sex trafficking, which is the sex buyers and the traffickers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so right. that is kind of the evolution over the last 14 years that I worked there at Phoenix PD that I witnessed happen.
So Heidi, do you think it was more of an impact on you when you saw that girl because it was one of your students, as opposed to just if it would have been just any other girl, that all of a sudden this was, holy cow, this is one of my students and now they're being trafficked, and kind of like hit you pretty hard?
Yeah, mainly because I never really thought it was a juvenile problem. I thought it was an adult problem. And then here is this girl that I remember her from when she was in seventh and eighth grade. And, you know, she was one where you would have her come up to you and give you a hug and all those things. And then on that day, here she is, this hardened, like, teenager, different attitude altogether. She's been branded. She had a tattoo of the pimp's name on her. And obviously seeing the change in her was heartbreaking. So, yeah, it definitely impacted me.
Yeah.
So I feel like where we're going to, with this is we're going to end up seeing who the real victims in this process end up being. But let's keep working on, because I want the listeners to hear a little bit more about your background, because you have a fascinating career. So this is the start. You've something has pricked your passion bug internally, and you're starting to see, and you're starting to beginning of what we see today, which is your, you know, this big passion of what really motivates you to do the great work out here that you're doing. So what happens next after this?
Yeah, so I tested for a position, and at the time we were starting our hiring freeze, and that hiring freeze went on for 8 years, which is what put us in this situation we have now, where you have people leaving off the top and no one to fill the bottom. But during that time, when I tested, I got assigned as a temporary position, and I was there for 6 months. They even sent me and another guy that was going to go to the other squad to Washington, D.C. area for training put on by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And so we attended that. And then when we came back, we heard the news that they're eliminating the third squad. So we had to go back to patrol. I actually was gone for about 8 months. I tested for community action officer. I had started that position. And then basically the vice spot came up again and I wanted to test. And the lieutenant at the time said, well, you'll have to be in a patrol position to be able to do that, because the rule is you have to stay a year. And so I, chancing it, risking it all to be stuck on a patrol squad, went and tested, transferred to a patrol squad, and then tested and got number one again, and was eventually positioned to be transferred there officially in January of 09. And so when I went there, that was also when we first started doing some of the hotel operations, where not only were you using female undercover officers out on the street, but we were also in the hotels. Posting ads. At the time it was Backpage.com. Now Backpage has been removed from the game here, and we have all these other websites that provide the opportunity for people to advertise people for purchase of sex. And that is, you know, the monster that we deal with now. But I definitely had limited training when I first started working undercover. Like, I remember a 20-minute briefing and then being put out on the street. And yes, I'm contacting a sex buyer. I have, you know, certain rules I apply to each contact to establish the crime. But I didn't really have, like, too much training. And looking back now, that's why I host my female undercover school, because this is crazy what mm-hmm. we were put in this position to do. And, you know, having an opportunity to share my expertise over the last 16 years now working undercover in different ways. I love to share that with, you know, female officers that want to possibly aspire to work this kind of crime.
So you were pretty cutting edge early on in this industry of undercover work, because what I hear you saying is, one is you're this maybe the law enforcement itself was looking at this in different through a different lens of utilizing female officers in a different way, but also this industry, we're now looking at it differently. Like you just described, this young woman who's been transformed into this, you know, this, this piece of merchandise now, for lack of a better term, they're a piece of property. And so now the industry is being looked at differently in law enforcement. Is that fair? Yeah. So there's two paradigms I feel like we're talking about here, that it's on the fly and you're on the front of it.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely evolved in our response to this crime. And the crime itself evolved, because now we're seeing more and more kids involved in this, because the demand is asking for younger and younger people, and the demand are the sex buyers. So the traffickers are supplying them with kids. So, you know, being able to mold ourselves and our response, where, you know, when I first started, we weren't even talking to pimps. We would act like every other girl out on the street, where we would not look at them. We'd keep on walking. We wouldn't engage with them. Whereas we started engaging with them. We started doing operations where we literally are targeting, I call it catfishing pimps, where I've got social media platforms that I've got, you know, thousands of followers on, and you never know who you're talking to. And those platforms I use specifically to engage with traffickers who are trying to recruit and groom me, who they think is a vulnerable individual that they can exploit. And, you know, the internet really allows for them to recruit and groom anonymously hundreds of profiles a day. And we need to be there for them to try and engage with us, so that, you know, we can get them instead of them exploiting an actual victim, a real person. So doing all of that, and we've, you know, we've evolved so much that we opened up our own massage parlor, and we did an 87 arrest operation in 10 days with sex buyers that had no problem asking for happy ending and all those things. And that's never been done before. You know, so we definitely are leading. Phoenix is leading in these undercover operations. And we're doing that with, I didn't say this earlier, but when I came back to test and actually got to the position, they had eliminated that third squad. And so we only had two squads. So we pretty much have had this whole time, I think maybe 9 detectives. We were fat once. We had 9 full detectives with 2 squads, with, you know, doing all of these efforts, all of this innovative, cutting edge stuff in the 5th largest city in the United States. So I always applaud my family, my vice guys. Well, we're human trafficking unit now, but they're definitely working so hard to try and put a dent in this problem.
So from here, we're transitioning to, again, I'm tapping in on to your continue to be motivated more and more to do, have a greater impact. From here, at what point do you start your organization, your founding organization of A Chance for Awareness?
Yeah. So in my 14 years almost at Phoenix Police Department, I've had lots of trials with traffickers that are truly evil, one of which has a record for the United States. It was a case of familial trafficking, and it involved an uncle who was trafficking his 13-year-old niece and his 17-year-old stepdaughter. And these two juveniles were in this situation with this man for several years. So this was you know, going on for a long time, and then 5 other adult females. And we were actually told to stop, because we had tried to identify as many victims as possible. So at 7, we were told, hey, guys, let's submit this case, because this has gone on and on and on. The case actually, from date of disclosure, where the 13-year-old, who was 16 when she finally disclosed, that day to the day we actually resolved this was 5 years. And we traveled all over the United States looking for victims and witnesses. This was a 105-count indictment. Well, the indictment is 130 counts, but what went to the jury was 105 counts, because some of the victims, you know, things that they tell us 5 years ago, if they can't remember in front of the jury, those things get dismissed. But 105 counts went to the jury, and he was found guilty on 101, and he was sentenced to 493.5 years in prison, which is a record for the United States. And in that whole investigation, I learned so much about how to be a better detective, how to be a better cop, how to be a better undercover, how to testify better, all of the things. And so that's where my passion comes from, with wanting to share my expertise with law enforcement in the form of training and using these case studies. So I have several traffickers I put away for more than 100 years, and I use those case studies when I teach, because I think we can instruct, but if you don't show them the outcome, what do they have to look forward to? So I think it's quite inspiring to share those wins with law enforcement so they can see what outcomes they can have.
It's awesome. So,
yeah, such a blessing to have. And there's no doubt you're making it sound easy, but your experience had to come through a lot of trial and tribulation and heartache, probably many tears. I mean, the entire concept is quite nauseous, you know, when we start this topic. So no doubt you've seen the scourge of a lot of humanitarianism.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those where, how do you not get affected listening to hundreds of victims over the years describe their worst several years of their lives? Because most of these victims have been in this situation for a while before they can... Yeah. You know, ultimately enough is enough and come forward and talk about it.
Yeah.
And then when you're doing it as an undercover, like when I'm being, when I'm catfishing a pimp, I've been screamed at, yelled at, threatened. They have no idea who they're talking to. And I'm, you know, affected by it. It may not be it's definitely not at the same level as an actual victim, but I definitely have felt this sleepless nights, especially going to trial against these truly evil people. And they have connections to gangs. They have, you know, I've had one trafficker do a public records request from prison for my personnel file. So lots of scary things that, you know, it is rewarding. It is challenging. It is necessary, but you also have to, protect yourself and your family.
Sure. Absolutely. Have you ever been an obvious feign of attack or even attack on you or your family?
I mean, not knock on wood.
Yeah, no, for all of us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, in an undercover capacity, I have been threatened, and I have one pimp almost hit me and all those things.
Sure.
Wow. So sex trafficking has gone on for years and years and years. And I don't know. I mean, it hasn't been talked about for a long time. But I think to a lot of people, when they hear the word sex trafficking, they just think maybe somebody that's been kidnapped and taken, and then we never see that person again. And then they're used for sex trafficking, you know, and maybe other states or other countries or things like that. Maybe if you could just explain the different types of sex trafficking that there is. I mean, you know what I mean? So the people that maybe don't understand as much can understand that this can be people right in our own neighborhood that maybe we're not aware that this is happening to them.
Yeah. So, so many people get sex trafficking or human trafficking confused with a kidnapping or other crimes. And it is a buzzword right now, and everyone is using it to label everything as human trafficking, especially on social media. You have influencers who are putting out there that a shopping cart was positioned behind my car. I could be being targeted as a trafficking victim, or a sticker was put on my window. I've never had a victim describe that happening to them that way. Not to say never, but that is not how this happens. Nor is abductions like you see on Taken or in the movies. That is a small percentage of how this happens. Most of how this happens is traffickers are skilled at using manipulation and grooming, just like you would think grooming with a child predator, very similar. They're seeking out vulnerable people to exploit. Someone who has lost their job, or who just got kicked out from their house, or is arguing with their parents. And unfortunately, we share on social media what we had for breakfast, what we're doing tomorrow. We share way too much information. And they're just sitting there on their couch looking for opportunities on all of these social media platforms to engage with, especially kids, to kind of private message them, compliment them. They invest time in getting to know them. They're asking personal questions like, where do your parents work? What kind of cars do they drive? Do they know that we're talking? Let's keep this a secret. you know, all of those things that, you know, give us the heebie-jeebies and like our warning signs of not letting your kids engage with these people. Unfortunately, the internet allows for all of that. And it really is trafficking by definition, force, fraud, or coercion. And so when I break that down and I do presentations to the community, because I should, you know, coin this phrase, an informed public equals an informed jury for me to hold these guys accountable, guys and gals. So I have to reach as many people in the community as possible because those are my future jurors. But they need to understand that when I testify that this person's a victim, number one, and number two, they're going to be walking down the side of the road with a phone in their hand. They are trapped. They're not free to leave. And I need a jury to wrap their head around that and understand that and find this person accountable for exploiting them, just the same as if you would envision someone being locked in a closet or handcuffed to a bed. And so having an informed public. But what I was saying with the definition, force, fraud, or coercion. And so force is pretty self-explanatory. That's going to be a violent incident, visible sign of injury, bruising, all those things. The fraud and the coercion are harder to explain and harder for people to understand. When we're talking about the grooming, we're talking about the coercion and the fraud. The fraud, as far as these traffickers offer all kinds of amazing things. I'm going to get you a car. I'm going to get you an apartment. We're going to go traveling. Do you want to go to Miami? Let's go. I'm going to take you to Vegas. I'm going to buy you clothes. We're going to go shopping. And if you're 14 years old, you know, and your parents aren't going to go, you know, get your hair done and your nails done, and this person's offering to do all of that for you, they're probably going to be lured in much easier.
Very appealing.
The coercion. Yeah, the coercion is the threats. I equate that to the threats. The reason why these traffickers are learning everything about you is you're thinking it's because they like you and you know, I'm going to be in a relationship with this person, but really they're learning those things about you so they can threaten you later. And another phrase that I have to copyright and coin, what I say all the time when I present on this is a trafficker or a pimp is the most reliable person you will ever meet. If they say they're going to beat your ass, they are going to beat your ass. If they say they're going to get you in the car and they're going to take you to your mom's house and they're going to shoot up your mom's house, depending on at the time if you apologize by then yet or make them feel you know, better about you, they're going to grab you up, kicking and screaming, stuff you in the car, drive to your mom's house and point that gun, because they need you, the victim, to believe that what I say is going to happen. Otherwise, these victims wouldn't stick around and stay in this situation. And so those threats are so real to these victims. They believe the hype. They believe all of this is going to happen. And they believe they have no other alternative other than to stay in this situation, even when they get arrested, even when they have detectives trying to offer them opportunities to leave. So it's an extremely challenging and difficult crime to investigate. And that's where using female undercovers, we're not going to change our story. We're not going to not testify. We're not going to not show up to court. And so it's very important to train and use female undercovers so that we can actually hold these people accountable. Because I've had hundreds of cases where I had a victim disclose, cooperate, did the warrant, busted down doors, booked the guy. A couple months later, they don't want to play the game of showing up to court, paying for parking, having to see this person, and then hearing it get continued. And then a couple months later, same thing, and over again for years and years. Because unfortunately, that's what happens with some of these cases. And they bow out. They change their mind, and this person gets released. And they're out to do it again. And they are doing it again. I've had four traffickers now that I've rearrested that either went to prison or jail that I booked, or that other situation happened where the victim bowed out. And I've had to re-arrest them and recharge them. And they were pimping kids again. And so now what I'm teaching, and I've developed a new class, it's about money laundering, illegal enterprise, and going after these traffickers financially alongside a victim-based case. Just in the off chance that your victim decides to bow out, you still have felony charges on this person. But that takes a lot of work. I have one case right now where I have 12 to 18 banks I've got to subpoena because these guys are super skilled at layering their finances. You know, obviously these traffickers are involved in other crimes, selling drugs, robberies, all kinds of other things, but they're also actually very business-wise, and they are creating fake LLCs, they're hiding their money, they're structuring, they're doing all the things that we would think of other criminal organizations, but we, law enforcement, we're not thinking that way about these pimps. We're delved into what we're going to get the victim justice. And we definitely are doing that too. But if we could go after them financially, we would have so much more that we could do to hold them higher, higher felonies and more accountable.
I like that. Yeah. Thank you.
I want to look at this conversation from two angles. I want to carve out a little bit of time here to talk about this, the book, which is intriguing to me. And forgive me, I haven't read it yet. I just hit the highlights. I looked at it, but the talk to them piece of that's a parent conversation. But I want to frame up a little bit. I don't want to leave the law enforcement piece too quickly. If you had some wisdom or advice for frontline officers that you would be okay with sharing. I know you're an entrepreneur and you're doing speaking, so engagements and sharing this, and you have a business there. But if there's something you could share to officers to say, hey, here's things to watch out for. Would you mind sharing some tips that because you know a lot of our they're not Phoenix PD. They're a 5-man department or a 20-man person department that they don't have the resources and assets, but they're probably seeing some small semblance of what you're describing. So what would be some things that some advice and wisdom that you would give officers to say, here's some things to look for and here's some questions to ask, some signs, symptoms, risks. What would those be?
So I teach at the academy and I talk about a Facebook Live that I captured where this trafficker was bragging about the officers not seeing him. He was holding up the phone, and I have the video that I play of him yelling at the girl that is with him, making her go inside and get whatever for him, cigarettes, I think it was, and then, showing that the police officers who are dealing with whatever emergency behind him weren't actually seeing him, and he's not wrong because we're not taught to see him. So I play that video on purpose because I want everyone to see that they think you're not going to see them. I also talk about the scenario of if you pull over a vehicle and you have someone super cooperative, overly nice to you, that should be a red flag in itself on any call. But you have victims in the car, and these guys know that they don't have drugs in the car. They don't have stolen property in the car. Go ahead and search my car, officer, because they're not worried about being caught by anything. Because as long as they control the mouth of those victims that are in the passenger seats and they don't say anything, they're not going to get caught for anything. So I know that there's, officer safety and certainly wait for a backup or two, but pulling these people out of the car, separating them, having conversations about where are you going? Where have you been? How long have you been with these people? What's your relationship with each other? Really goes a long way to also, in addition to your own observations of condoms on wrappers on the floor and the floorboard of the car, and it looks like they have hotel receipts and all the other evidence, put two and two together once you get them separated that you probably have a situation where you need to call a detective, especially if it's a juvenile, whether she's disclosing or not or cooperative or not. Maybe she's an outstanding runaway. Maybe it's, out past curfew and you can detain her or him. However you can find a way, pray to the warrant gods, what we do, to get these people detained and transported for a detective to talk to them is what my advice would be. And certainly making it a policy at your agency, if it's a kid, we're gonna definitely call a detective out.
I think nearly every state has a because it's become such a growing trend. And so difficult and elusive. I think each state has assigned this to a state agency, and obviously there's federal agencies, but I would maybe ask that in the form of a question. Would it not be beneficial to call that agency as well? Or maybe if you're have a large agency close like Phoenix or Salt Lake City, just say, hey, here's what I got. Does this make sense? What does it look like? I'm not trained in this. Is that fair?
Yeah. And you know what's even better? Well, not better, but LinkedIn is huge for me. I post questions, hashtag question for the group on LinkedIn all the time. And I've had officers, I had one officer in Tennessee messaged me on LinkedIn. She was on a call right then. I'm not always on LinkedIn, but I happened to see her message and I called her and talked her through the call she was on, and, you know, resulted in an interview and calling detectives and those kind of things. So, you know, being networked on LinkedIn, I think is a really good resource. Yeah. There's groups like the human trafficking group. And the way that I can also drive this home is I had a pimp that I was catfishing from Orlando, and I didn't, I talked to him for about 6 months, in fact. And when we argued and got to the end of this situation, he was going through all of my friends on my social media account and critiquing me. Why do you know this person? Why do you know this person? And why do you know this girl? She snitched on such and such pimp in Baltimore. Why are you friends with her? And I, you know, I don't know, daddy. I just am friends with everybody. Isn't that the idea, to have as many friends as possible? I dismissed it away. But what was crazy about him knowing, he's in Florida. The pimp in Baltimore was arrested by the girl on my other squad's undercover social media that she had catfished him like a few weeks before. So how did he know that with this Baltimore guy? And we don't even talk to each other across the United States. And we're law enforcement. We're supposed to be networked. They're more networked than we are, and that needs to change. So definitely, if anyone has a question, wants training, wants to contact me about a case, I am absolutely available on LinkedIn. You just have to message me. It's under my name, Heidi Chance, and I've helped a lot of officers that way.
Never ceases to amaze me how incredibly, I mean, we like to think all criminals are dumb. I think they do dumb things, but they're pretty smart and pretty savvy. I mean, even just you commenting about the networking piece of what they're doing, that's pretty savvy. And clearly they're, in some areas, they're more savvy about it than the law enforcement game. We're hindered by a lot of things, but, so let's transition to, in kind of our remaining time here, I want to talk about this parent, the book. Let me frame this up this way. You introduce the book, talk to them. Tell me about the book, and then let's talk about how we talk to our kids.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. So when doing all these community presentations, I kept telling the audience, when I first started investigating this crime, the national average age of entry into sex trafficking was 15. That was back in 2005, 2006. Today, it's 13. And recently, I've worked with a bunch of Phoenix officers out on the track, which is the known area for prostitution. And they recovered some 11, 12-year-olds. And I tell the audience that. I tell the community that because I want them to realize this is happening younger and younger. And when I'm, you know, scaring them intentionally with these facts, sure, I've been asked so many times, well, how do we talk to our kids about this? And so that's what the book is. This is the how to have a conversation, a difficult conversation about not only sex trafficking, but the growing issue of sextortion, luring a minor for sex, other crimes, all of those things that could happen on social media, on the internet, and on these games. And so this book is how to guide to have these difficult conversations. And I modeled it after being a forensic interviewer, how I would conduct a victim interview with someone who really doesn't want to talk to me. And I might have some skills to impart in this book on how to get them to talk to you and how to have that conversation to get them to say what happened to them on their worst day. And I use those tactics and strategies in the book to kind of give parents a strategy on how to have a conversation. Because if we don't have parents conversing with their kids about this, by the time you or I meet them as law enforcement, the thing's already happened. It's too late. And so I would much rather have never meet these people and their kids and have them have this situation happen. And that only happens if they stop relying on other people to do it, like the school or someone else. No one else is going to do it. You as the parent, it's the job of a parent to do this and have these conversations so that we can prevent this from happening in the first place.
I think so many times parents, and I'm really fortunate, my boys are grown. My boys are 28 and 30, and I love them. They're contributing members of society today, and I'm proud of that. But man, the challenges and potholes and landmines just seem to be more and more now than ever in our history. It just seems So as a parent, where do you start with that conversation? I mean, what's your take on how you really sit down and say, holy shit, I'm going to have a really hard conversation. How do I do this? Because I think all of us, all three of us, our experience with, out here is that most people say it could never happen to me. And we, all three of us, have worked in an industry where we work with the people that, guess what? It happened to you. And that's why I'm here across the table from you. So how do you start having these conversations?
Yeah, I think just like interviewing a victim, I think even as basic of where, like, is it best to have this conversation in the car when you're driving them to school and you're distracted by the drive itself and they're in the back seat, they may not even be paying attention to you, they're not looking at you in the eye, that's probably not the right place. Just like when we're interviewing a victim, is it a good idea to do that out on the side of the road? Probably not. We need to transport them to a room where we can sit down and offer them a drink and, you know, not have them be seen by other people and all the things. The timing of it. I've had victims falling asleep across the table from me because their trafficker had them working 24/7 and they'd get beat up if they failed to answer the phone for a date. Not the right time to talk to that victim in the moment of, you know, trying to get to the bottom of what happened to them. I have to have patience. I have to pull it back and wait for them to be ready. Same thing with a kid that just came home from school and they're excited about the day. They want to go play their game. This new game just came out and then you want to sit them down. They're not going to be thinking about what you're saying. They're going to be thinking about the game. So finding, and this is like case by case, family by family, dynamic itself, decisions you as the parent have to make of the timing, the location, and then the starting of the conversation. I relate that to not being lecturing, not being it be like they're in trouble or anything, but make it be a casual thing where, oh my gosh, I saw this TikTok the other day and the mom, blah, blah, blah. And she, this thing happened to her daughter. What do you think about that? And kind of get the conversation in a roundabout way started by using examples of other things so that it doesn't come off as you lecturing and those kind of things. That's just, you know, some examples of how I would start it. Sure. And then it needs to be a repeated thing. This is not a one and done thing. This has to be a learned expectation, a continual conversation all throughout their growing up, really, to keep them ultimately protected from these things. That's what I would suggest.
And I'm sure it has to be more common and more repetitive because it's probably not the most comfortable conversation to have. You know, this makes the talk, you know, with our kids seem much easier, you know, than talking about, you know, the things that can happen and the real reality of, you know, talking to somebody on an app or in a game or something, and they think that's who they're talking to. You know, they really have no clue. And so I think it has to, like you said, needs to be more of a constant conversation, you know, repetitive of ongoing, you know, about this kind of a thing. So
I think go ahead.
Well, I think you're having to introduce the concept of really vile human behavior. So now you're having to talk about bad people and what they may not look like, you know, the villain on TV. They actually may look like the neighbor. And so then it becomes really difficult to narrate differences, what you're looking for, how. But I feel like what you're saying is these are necessary conversations of if you want to protect your kids.
Yeah, it's the job of a parent now.
Yeah. Yeah. So within your book, and again, apologize for not reading your book, Heidi, within your book, but I did do some of the preamble of it. I think, do you start explaining and defining what some of the behaviors of these people are and help a parent maybe educate the parent a little bit as to what to be looking for? Is that included in your book? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to understand, you know, the myths that we believe, what we're seeing on social media, and then obviously the reality of it. And in, you know, section form, like this is sex trafficking, this is sextortion, this is luring a minor for sex, you know, breaking it down that way so they can see the differences in the crime and how it happens.
Sure. Absolutely.
And I mean, really, we're in the, you know, we see some of this stuff with our jobs, and so we're in the business of it, but you know, there's so many parents out there that are just as naive to this as the kids are. And so for them to kind of understand what's going on and you know what I mean, how this stuff works, I think that's huge. I think that's great that that's in the book to help parents understand what to see and what to look for.
Literally last week, one of my squad mates pulled me aside and said, "Hey, another police agency just asked my wife and my 15-year-old to go down to the station. And I found out that it was because she sent an inappropriate image of herself to someone she thought was a peer. And it was actually an adult. And that adult was arrested. And that image was found on the phone. And this is how the shit rolls backwards." But those parents of that 15-year-old are both cops. So it isn't that we are oblivious or, you know, not, it's not going to happen to our kids either. We can't just, you know, do the job and then come home and think that they know. We actually also have to have the conversation. So when I say parents, I mean everybody.
Good point.
Well, and that leads into to where I was, the question I was actually going to pose, which was, what are some red flags things? And what had come to mind was, you know, the phone, pictures, social media. What are some red flag things that some parents could see? Maybe behavior changes or tech changes, differences. What are some red flag things that would indicate a child is going down a road that is pretty dangerous?
Well, if it's a situation where you haven't established, you know, these rules where devices can't be in your bedroom, games can't be played, you know, with the closed door and your headphones on, or a phone that you're on that I don't have parental controls over, those kind of things. If that doesn't exist, you know, you're going to find the image that was sent. You're going to find the conversation where this bad guy is suggesting that they do these things, meet, where they delete messages, where they speak in code, where they, you know, keep things a secret from you. You're going to find those things out, hopefully. But I think to preempt all of that, we need to establish the expectations. When you give these kids a device, you know, it's a huge situation where we can try and limit, you know, push it off to a certain age. But I've had kids, you know, engage with these people in secret at school because their friends have devices. So they're going to get exposed to all of this anyway. Even though we try and hide it from them, we try and keep it from them with not giving them the opportunity to have a device, they're going to get exposed anyway. So the best armor and prevention for this is to talk about it and talk about these things that will happen. And I call it so that when it does happen, because it isn't if, it is when, then they can self-police themselves and recognize, wait a minute, my mom told me about somebody telling me to delete stuff and keep things a secret. I wonder if this is a bad guy, like she told me. And then if you have a great relationship with your kid and continue conversations, she's going to come to you, mom and dad, and say, hey, this is weird. What do you think about this? And tell you about it so that you can stop it. And also they're going to stop it themselves because they're going to recognize what you told them about, and they're not going to engage with that person anymore. They're going to think that they're a creeper, which is what we want them to think they're a creeper and not continue talking to them. So very important. I think the best armor is talking to our kids. That's the name of the book.
Love that.
Wow. Well, albeit a heavy conversation and a heavy topic, Heidi, I love the fact that you are so passionate about that and that we have advocates for our kids out here like you. And I just can't thank you enough, not just for what you've done, but what you're continuing to do in this community and this this nation of advocating for our kids. I'm very passionate about that myself. If, as we kind of wrap up here, if people wanted to find you, how do they get a hold of you? How do they find the book? How do they, maybe somebody wants to have you come in as a motivational speaker. How do they, what's all the good stuff of how they find Heidi Chance?
Yeah. So, like I said before, my LinkedIn is pretty strong. I think that might be where we met. But
I think
LinkedIn,
it was.
Yeah. Heidi Chance under my name. And I also have a business page, A Chance for Awareness. Pun intended on my last name. But my business and my website, achanceforawareness.com, basically is two missions: the continued community awareness to create an informed public, to have an informed jury, and then two, law enforcement training. Not only do I do a patrol recognition class, I have the victim interviewing class, I have a suspect interrogation class. I mean, we all think we're good interrogators, but we every now and again should do a refresher, because talking to a pimp is a different ball game, because especially if you send in a female detective to interview a pimp, I've had interviews with traffickers that lasted 4 or 5 hours because they'd rather talk to me than a male. And they're going to talk a lot about, almost like they're trying to recruit and groom me as the detective. They fall into back into their game and they spew their game on you. And it's all very, very valuable information in that interview, and getting them to do that is a skill as well. And then I have a class about putting this all together for successful prosecution, because these cases are typically this person's word against that person's word. We're not going to have a witness that saw this person go have sex with somebody, make money, and then turn that money over to their trafficker unless we have multiple victims coming forward. And so being able to build this case with corroborative evidence enough to put it through to prosecution is also something that I like to teach, so that we can get as many pimps off the streets as possible. And then my other class, like I said, the illegal enterprise money laundering. I've had lots of cases where I've actually did an entire case starting with them being in custody, because the pimping game doesn't stop just because they're in jail, even awaiting trial. And having relationships with jail intelligence and banking institutions and other, like I call it, the team, that you can call on and get data and evidence to go after them financially is huge. And then I do have my female undercover school. I'm actually hosting that soon. I'm not sure when you have this episode coming out, but I do a virtual as well as in person 3 to 4 hour female undercover school, where I talk about obviously targeting sex buyers and traffickers using female undercovers and catfishing pimps too. So I also do a lot of case studies. I have a whole case study on the Guillen trial, the one that was almost 500 year sentence, because I think prosecutors also need to attend these trainings so they can see in that trial. I mean, I did a warrant. I was, still interviewing people in the trial, and all the things that happened with it and the outcome that we got to. It was definitely a learning experience, and I like to share all that. But all of that is at my website, A Chance for Awareness, including booking me for a speaking engagement, whether it's a class on one of these law enforcement classes, or I also have a human trafficking training for the public that I recorded. I just released a situational awareness class because I've been asked by women's organizations to do a general situational awareness class, and I think I might know a thing or two being an undercover in a bad area of town with the criminal element all around me, staying safe and being aware, some of the tactics and things that I picked up along the way as a female undercover, I share those things in that class. And then I do have a digital literacy for parents class that I do that kind of goes more in depth on the book, which is available on Amazon or really anywhere where books are sold. And what's very cool about the book is I'm having it translated in Spanish right now. I'm supporting a female officer that I met on LinkedIn. She's a officer at one of the universities, I think in Mississippi, maybe Missouri, it starts with an M. But I've reached out to her, and she is all in to translate it in print form, as well as she's recording herself reading it in Spanish for an audiobook, so that we can reach a non-English speaking demographic of parents to have this information also, because that's critical with parents that don't know what's going on with these devices and these phones. And these traffickers know it too. and they're looking for those kids as well, because that's kind of a vulnerability that their parents don't speak the same language as them. So.
Wow, that's great. Heidi, you're doing great work. Thank you so much for coming on the No One Fights Alone podcast, and thank you for what you're doing out here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Heidi.
Yeah, nice to meet you both.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.